So this is just a really fun time to kind of talk about y'all, like women in science. And as a younger scientist, this is really cool to be able to see. So I know I get to see you in the hallways all the time and maybe lunch with y'all, but for everyone else, can we kind of go through, like, what is your name? How are you involved at LumCon? What area do you study?
So for those of you who don't know me, my name is Abigail Bacchus. I am an assistant professor here at LumCon, and I've been a professor for 3 years. But I've been studying science and been involved in science for more than 12. And my research focuses on fish biology, and I study aquaculture, which is farming fish for food. And so I make sure that we are feeding fish the right nutrients to help them grow and stay healthy.
Okay. Hi, everybody. My name is Juliana Dandrilli, and I'm an assistant professor at LumCon as well. I just recently started my appointment in late 2019, so I had just almost 1 year of professorship at LumCon under my belt, but I've had 5 years of professorship at a different university, and I think about career stage from the point in which I felt like a scientist and then grew into a different scientist. So been involved in science for more than 17 years and then worked in industry, came back to academia, and have since then moved forward in an academic career for about 11 years. And environmental chemistry. So when I think about carbon, I think about all the different chemical molecules that move in and out of aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems all over the world.
My name is Nancy Rabelais. I am currently a professor and the Shell Endowed Chair for Oceanography Wetland Sciences at Louisiana State University, and I hold a distinguished professorship at LumCon, where I began my first post-PhD employment 37 years ago. And if I consider my time as a scientist at the University of Texas Marine Science Institute before I went back to work on my PhD, I would have to say that my career experience is about 44 years right now. And my area of interest, I've had a broad research career over the years with all sorts of different projects, but the ones that I am focused on right now relate mostly to human interactions with the environment and their impacts, including low oxygen conditions in the Gulf of Mexico and oil and gas activities on wetlands.
I'm Stephanie Archer. I'm also an assistant professor at LumCon, where I've been a professor for a grand total of 8 months. Because my mom really did a wonderful job of encouraging my nerdiness, I think I've been some form of a scientist most of my life. I've been a PhD-level scientist for about 5 years now. And I work on ecosystems that are formed by plants and animals, like coral reefs, things like that, oysters, and try to figure out how they work and how human activities are changing how they work.
I love the, like, difference in everything y'all do. It's so cool to hear. So then with what you're doing now, what got you involved in science? What made you want to be a scientist?
Well, I'll start. I knew in eighth grade biology that I was going to be a biologist. It was probably the teacher and her ability to get me interested. On to high school, I took 2 biology classes. It was to avoid taking physics, which was never my favorite topic, even in undergraduate. And also living in Corpus Christi, Texas, which is on the Gulf Coast, I began to spend more time at the beach, learned how to scuba dive, and that got me interested in marine research. And my undergraduate, the last 2 years of my undergraduate were spent at a regional college, Texas A&I University, and many of the field trips took me to marine habitats in South Texas, and I just started learning the natural history and appreciating it, and it went from there.
Yeah, I'll chip in too. So I was born and raised in Kansas, which is about as far from the ocean as you can get, and somehow I became a marine biologist, and people are always like, what's happening? How did that happen? Yeah. And like, I don't have a great answer, but the easiest way I can describe it is like, people who want to become a doctor probably haven't cut into a body before, but they know they like it, or they want to do it. I felt the same way. I was like, why do you like the color blue? Like, this is my jam. This is what I want. And so I pushed really hard to make that happen, and I made it happen. And so I feel like that's a good example. Like, it's so amazing in Nancy's case, people who have these opportunities to get involved and have the experience. And I didn't really have that. But I just really wanted to make it happen, so I did it.
You crushing it too.
Let's go.
So I'll jump in there. I also actually grew up in the middle of the country, Missouri and Kansas, back and forth between the two. And I knew I wanted to do science of some sort because I spent a lot of time outside. I loved math. And science is really one of the only careers that I could see that combined those two things. And then I got exposed to marine science in high school by a really amazing teacher who thought it was really important kids from the middle of the country know something about the ocean because most of our planet is the ocean. I'd been to the ocean before, but I had never really thought about all the things that lived under there. And it was that course that really kind of changed my life, put me down the marine ecology field in particular.
My answer builds on everybody's answers, if I can use everybody's experiences. So mine starts with my mom, which connects with Stephanie's story, how she wanted both of her children to connect with nature at a very young age. And I grew up on Long Island in New York on the beach. So it was anything outside of the house all the way to the ocean. There were always things to look at, things to listen to, things to hold in your hands and connect with. And she was a huge advocate for that. So by the time I took science classes in school, it just became just one of those other things that you really enjoy. So then along Nancy's answers, I had a fantastic set of biology, chemistry, and physics teachers in high school. And I went to college and tried them all and see which one I loved the most. And then that goes into the way Abigail explained her answer, because I wound up, while loving biology, excelling in a more excited and curious way in chemistry and physics. And I had the educators push me and support me throughout that process. And then it just became a big old solid line through all those stories, because my greatest love in science is learning about, understanding, and helping the environment. And I can do that as a chemist and a physicist and learn about how things are, how they will change, and what we can do to make it a better place for the future.
I have a comment on mothers and parents encouraging certain types of careers. Growing up in the 60s with a mother who grew up in the and was a stay-at-home mom with four children, she encouraged me or demanded that I take typing as a junior in high school, which definitely is worth doing, and taking stenography as a senior in high school because I would need to be able to get a job when I got out of high school. And I was not expected to be where I am today at all by my family. I never went camping. I never got to do much outside until I left home and worked my way through college and discovered all these other things. So people my age may have very different experience with beginnings of their love of biology or science or marine science than I did.
So then with that in mind, like I've mentioned a lot about support, how you got there and how some people weren't really expecting it to pan out, how you pushed and were able to make it happen. And were there ever any doubts about like becoming a scientist because of the fact that there were not that many women in science? It seemed like a role that was really new and needed to be broken into. Like, did you ever second guess yourself because of that?
I would just say that, again, going back to my mom, she really instilled a self-confidence and to the point of being blissfully unaware for me I was well into this whole becoming a professional scientist thing, well into my PhD before I really realized that it was going to be harder because I'm a woman. It never really crossed my mind that it was something that I might not, that other people might not expect to do. I guess for myself, no, it never, being a woman never entered the equation.
Yeah. I'll say, I feel sort of similar. Like when I was younger, thinking about going into it, you're just like so jazzed. And so I didn't have any reservations, but I would say now that I'm further along in my career, maybe some of those discrepancies on more men being involved than women, like I'm more aware of that. Like I'll see these committees and they're all men or maybe one woman on a huge committee of 15 people. And so I feel like now I'm a little more aware of how it might be harder to break into some of those circles as a woman.
I had a similar experience with that as well. It didn't come from my parents. They were very open about anything I wanted to do. If I wanted to study something one day and something the next, they were fine with all of that. I don't even think we ever had a conversation about expectations in the professional sense. Whatever gender you are. I don't even think we had that conversation. It was just support and how are you going to get there and then go do it. I met adversaries once I got to graduate school in terms of that split where you see different departments and different ratios of different genders, predominantly male in chemistry and physics. And that level of expectation was brought to me on my first week of orientation in graduate school. And it was very much a situation in which I was told I would never be successful as a scientist.
Wow.
And I had never heard that from my parents, from my instructors, educators at any level. It wasn't until I entered that further along professional education career that I started to hear that very often.
Wow.
It's good to open your eyes and see what's around you and to learn from it. And certainly did not prohibit any of my drive to continue on and to become successful if I could do it.
I would say that I never let it obstruct my desire to become a scientist and to do the research that I've done over the years. However, I don't want to say many, but I had very significant views of a former director that women weren't good scientists. And he did his best to get rid of me, and I was non-tenure track, which means that even if I didn't survive this, I still would not get a job. And then another assistant professor going to associate professor, which is, you know, it's a big deal, and it can shape your career. At that point, she and I both fought, and we won, and we were continue our careers. I continued on at LumCon. She eventually left and went to NOAA as a program manager. But the fact that I might not have the continued opportunities that I had worked so hard to build not be a part of my future, that is what made me consider, do I want to be a scientist? And that was because of the sexism. Right? I have also been subjected to sexual harassment, and that's not pleasant, but I managed to, one of the things I believe is being professional in all ways, and that passed, but it was not a very comfortable situation.
Wow. So I know, Juliana, you said something that kind of like stuck with me. You had mentioned it's good to be aware. Keep your eyes open. Like, it's good to recognize what's going on. Does anyone else have any good advice for, like, a young woman going into science? Like, what advice would you have given yourself looking back, your younger self? What would you tell yourself?
Mine is I still give to myself all the time. It's being professional at all times. Working hard, it's being creative, it's accomplishing things in science so that nobody can doubt your scientific credentials. And to try to surround myself with a broad cohort of colleagues that support me and support the joint research that we do, and that's been, I think, my savior over the years.
So I'll build on those. Kind of speaking about what Juliana said, initially is that I actually wish I was aware of some of the challenges earlier on that would be put in because I am a woman, just so I would have better tools to fight back against those blocks. And so educating yourself about the difficulties that you will face. For a really good example of this is your letters of recommendation as a woman will be more likely to focus on service rather than your excellence in science. So having gathering materials that document this in a scientific way and maybe giving those to your letter writers before they write a letter sort of thing. And then building on one of the things that Nancy said is learn early that it's okay to remove yourself from toxic situations, whether that's with a mentor or a peer group, and surround yourself with people who are really supportive. There's science is a big field now. There's lots of really amazing people in it, and find the people that you work best with. And then learn how to say no. Women get asked to do a lot of things that men in this field don't get asked to do. And so learning to say no early and often and being honest with yourself about when you need to is a big one.
Wow. Yeah. What's up, Juliana?
Yes. I wanted to first and foremost say it's wonderful listening to everybody's answers. It's wonderful to be able to build on top and think about how much of it is relatable to all of us, because that's what I'm sensing so far in the conversation. I've been thinking a lot about this question, what advice would you give to your, may have thought about it since Tori originally asked me a week ago, and what that might mean that hasn't already been said. I think the biggest difference in being more prepared for the next hurdles that I faced with that particular example of a professor saying, you'll never make it, that type of, when you meet that type of communication in your career. I think about my very strong chemistry and physics department professors from undergraduate and would have given the advice to myself back then to ask more questions of them, as in what's out there, right? I didn't have a good idea of what was out there. My undergraduate departments were flooded with professional women. And that showed me something that didn't exist when I went to the next industrial position or the next institution in general. And the best advice I would like to give myself is to ask more questions about how to be prepared and then what to look for in a good mentor. So the things that Stephanie and Nancy have touched on in terms of hold on to those healthy relationships, but how to look for the strengths in good, strong support systems.
Yeah, I mean, everything everyone said is so great, and I have an answer too. Something a little different. So like I said, I'm from Kansas, and I was actually raised in a really conservative household, sort of this man as the head of the household, you know, dynamic. And I didn't realize until I was almost done with graduate school that I have a natural capacity to sort of defer leadership or defer someone heading a project that's a man. And I caught myself doing that, and then I realized I actually know way more about that than that guy. So why am I not coming to myself to say, hey, you could do that. You could lead that. And so it's actually something I've been working on in myself to basically just like know your own strengths, know what you know, and like believe in yourself that you can totally do that. And I don't know if anyone else has experienced that too, but that's something that I've had to work on internally, which I think is like really deeply ingrained in certain parts of our society.
Wow. So with that recognition, go for it.
I have a yin-yang attitude towards saying no. I am not capable of saying no often because the yeses bring me opportunities, even if they may overload me with work. But one of the things that I did, and many of you probably are doing, is that I volunteered a lot within scientific societies and review panels and reviews. This all led to me being established as a good peer that led to even greater responsibilities as a chair of the Ocean Sciences Board of the National Academy of Sciences or the president of the Coastal and Estuarine Research Federation. They put me up against a well-known estuarine ecologist. I thought, I don't have to worry about this. And I got elected, so I do it. And don't say no too often. If you say no because it's not fair, that's definitely justified. But my inability to say no has gotten me into a lot of working groups and relationships that have only made my career much better.
I'll build on that. I think for a lot of that, I would agree with Nancy. It's about not just reflexively saying yes, I guess. Taking time to think about it and being comfortable saying no when it is the right thing for you. Because for myself, it's hard to say no to when I know it's not the thing I should be doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, go for it.
I think like along those lines too, as a woman, there's the potential that experiences might not get dropped in our lap as often as men. So pursuing those, being like, hey, I like that. How do I get involved in that? Like, don't be afraid to speak up. And also, I think like with research or your career, it's really scary to try something when you don't really feel like you know what you're doing. So just not being scared to just start, just try it, you know, just like, even for me now, like it's hard to like write that first paragraph or reach out to that person, but just always putting yourself out there. Like Nancy said, that's how you build your network and you get involved. You got to try.
Yeah. Has that gotten better? Like you said, things don't really get dropped in the lap as much. And everything y'all have talked about is about you going out and you're pursuing this. You are breaking down those walls. Like, has there been any development to a better pipeline to create those opportunities for women, or better, just a better way for women to excel in science specifically?
I began my volunteerism with regional science societies, the Texas Academy of Science and the Gulf Estuarine Research Society. And that broadened my set of colleagues to at least the entire Gulf Coast. And I could learn a whole lot from them. And they supported me in what I was doing in these roles. So I've only had very good experiences, mostly, with the things I get involved in. They may end up being too much work, but I may possibly be appointed to the National Academy of Science Committee on Oil in the Sea, number 4. I served on number 3, and those people remember if you do a good job or not along the way. And if you are doing a good job and you are contributing and you are thoughtful, then those opportunities are just going to grow.
Have you seen a shift? Dr. Abloy, have you seen a shift or gradual changes maybe in the culture of marine science over your career in regards to women in science?
I would say I have definitely seen a shift from when I began in the 60s, 70s. It was certainly male-dominated at that time, but not the men were dominating. Many of the men were supportive, and that helped a whole lot. I would say when I started working on a more international basis, mm-hmm. in lots of things that I did, that there were women in other countries who held very high and prestigious positions. And I also became aware that parts of Europe, particularly Scandinavia, really supported women scientists and helped them build their careers. I'm not sure that's the same in the U.S., but it certainly is that way in other countries. You don't develop a proposal to do something interesting with biogeochemistry in the Baltic Sea without including female scientists. And many of the principal investigators have written op-eds for Nature and Science concerning the need to get more women involved in science. So that's a very different attitude than I find in the U.S. And it has changed over the years. there are many more men who support female scientists now than there were when I was coming up in my career.
So I'll add on a little bit to the international bit that Nancy mentioned. One thing, so I've lived and worked in Canada for a bit. I was at a government agency. In the U.S., is often quite dominated. And I worked in one of the sections that received the most funding in the Pacific region, and we had one male out of 30 people. It was an eye-opening experience. And almost every single one of the women that I worked with had children. And the reason that they were able to have fulfilling family careers, family life and careers, there's a year of family leave in Canada.
Whoa.
Work-life balance and expectations are dramatically different. It's expected that family comes first and science comes second. And it's a very different culture, and it not only helps the women, but it also, I feel like, helped the men. They were able to stay home with their families as well when they had new children. Just that level of support removed something that I think can present a barrier to a lot of women, this perceived notion that you might have to choose between having a family and having a career in science. There was none of that, I think. And so just that simple thing changed a lot.
Yeah,
and
we
were bad at family leave.
Yeah. We had some really interesting conversations with faculty members a little bit older than me at other institutions. Like this woman, she has kids, and she was saying that male faculty members there could easily be like, I need to leave early today. You know, I have to go pick up my son from whatever, but she felt like she had to hide it when she had to do that because the expectations, even if it's the same situation, for men and women can be different. That's hard.
And so how do y'all manage the work-life balance between being a scientist and your at-home life?
Before we leave, what Abigail just talked about.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
Add that I am on a committee for the LSU Faculty Senate that looks at complaints from individuals about their treatment or unfair practices or lots of different things. But one of the current issues is that a male requested a extension on the tenure clock because he and his wife were expecting a newborn. He was denied. If a woman had possibly submitted the request, but she wasn't an LSU faculty member, she probably would have been encouraged and supported. So there are reverse discrimination on our elders or our supervisors as to the role of women and men in home life.
Wow.
And I find that very disappointing.
And really, it shouldn't be up for debate. It should be automatic. But
absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so in terms of work-life balance, when I was in graduate school, I, like, turned in some assignment, and my professor wrote this note on the bottom of the assignment that said something to the extent of, like, the workplace will always ask for more, resist. And I, like, tore it off, put it up on my desk, and, like, it's hard. Science is demanding, and I think you have to choose how much you're willing to work, and we all work really hard, and then you have to put your foot down. It's not always going to be the case that your employer is going to be like, oh, yeah, prioritize your family. You have to fight for it. So I think all of us feel very comfortable telling our family to wait because we have to work, but we don't always feel comfortable telling work to wait because our family needs us. And so I think personally, I'm just working on that.
Getting to spend the time in Canada where work-life balance was more of an expectation than it is in the U.S. More than once in my first couple years there, I was told to go home, to go take vacation, get out of the office. And slowly over my time there, I did start to set much better boundaries about work-life balance. I work when I work. I don't work when I don't. And I restrict the number of hours that I work unless there's an extreme extenuating circumstance. And I've found that I'm actually more creative, more productive, and happier. Even though I love what I do, if I didn't set these rules, I would easily work most of the time because I get engrossed in what I'm doing. But I think for the benefit of my science and for myself, it works a lot better to set strict boundaries, and learning to stick to them is hard because especially in graduate school, you get in the set of just constantly like working and that being normalized. But science needs to be the only thing in your life.
Stephanie, I think I could have used your advice while I was coming up a science career. I really do. I never knew when to let go.
For me, inside the boundary conditions that Stephanie talked about, I still try to organize timed, scheduled moments of when to focus on what. And this is something that I've been comfortable doing for a really long time. So it's already in me. I like being busy, but inside the busyness, there's scheduled moments for each type of project or connection or brainstorm. And I thrive with that kind of turn your brain on in one way and then turn it off in another. When it gets muddied, it's very difficult. So I like that rigid portioning throughout the day. Or if the day didn't work and I'm only scheduling in the evening, that type of thing. Coming in and then walking away also exists with packets of when to do what inside those boundary conditions.
Yeah, this is like a little off topic, but
for it.
When we were thinking about like, what is it like to be a woman in science? So Nancy gave a great example of like a very obvious, horrible situation that occurred that was based in sexism. But I feel like a lot of the things that I experience are subtler than that. Like it can almost be hard to tell, is this because I'm a woman? Is this because I'm a little bit younger than you? Like, I find that like really hard to figure out how to combat. And I would just like to hear people's opinion on like, I mean, we know there's discrepancies. And so how do we fight against it if we can't even identify it happening?
That's a good question, Abigail. But I'll go back to it because my whole life had two phases. I have been married twice now and I am still married to my second husband. But I would say that my science career was not necessarily supported by my first husband. And it made it difficult. And not just because of the work hours, but because of a personality who wanted to be better than everybody else and saw me as competition. My second marriage to Gene Turner at LSU has been a blessing. He has the same work ethic as I do about doing good science and staying on top of everything. And we have a daughter, Emily, that we both supported each other in her raising so that we could both conduct our careers. And I'm not sure I could have done what I have done now without his support. So that's just my story of my how to deal with a home life and everything else, along with science and career and traveling. It really helps to have a good partner in that. Now that I've gone on, Abigail, what is the subtle things that you don't know how to quite deal with, or
just, I don't know, sometimes the enemy, you can't see it, right? Like, sometimes men are just preferentially chosen. Like, sometimes it's not easy to see what's hard about being a woman in science. And I feel like those are the hardest questions to answer because, yeah, work hard, put yourself out there. But I just would love to hear people's opinion. I mean, for me, that was the hardest thing when I was thinking about this topic. Don't know how to fight against that all the time.
I think it depends a lot on the personalities that you're dealing with because they bring a different history with them and ways of dealing with women in science. I predict that the next 25, 50 years is going to be much better for female scientists than it is right now because the old guard will be retiring and moving on. And in my opinion, the new guard has a much better appreciation for non-sexist decision making and things like that. But those insidious things are hard to deal with.
My response to this is that I actually resisted for a long time reading about biases against women and what it's like to be a woman in science. Because I was like, I don't need to read that. I am a woman in science. But one of the things that has changed when I kind of gave in and started reading about the actual studies that have been done about biases and what the challenges are is that it helps me identify when those subtle things might be something that I just think I'm noticing versus when it is something that I know other people have experienced or is a tendency. And it helps take away that nagging question of, like, am I crazy or did that happen because I'm a woman? Which is helpful if that helps at all.
I think that's awesome. That, like, reminds me, I was in a meeting with someone, and it's like you're saying, you're having this am I crazy moment, where the whole dialogue, the whole conversation just felt really condescending. I was like, oh, like, this sucks. Like, I'm, like, feeling bad about, like, how this meeting is going down. And that experience helped me recognize that here at LumCon, we have a lot of senior male faculty, and they never make me feel that way. They never make me feel super young and that I don't know what I'm talking about. I don't feel like gender dynamics come into our professional interactions, and it made me appreciate it so much that I don't have to deal with those negative dynamics. So sometimes when you experience them, yeah, it gives you that, I'm not crazy, this can happen, and this is how it feels when it's not happening, and it's awesome.
So Abigail, tell us about your home life and how it's affected by being a woman in science.
Great question. So my partner's a lawyer, and since I'm a new professor, and he's a new lawyer, we both have pretty demanding work schedules, and that kind of works for us right now. I'll also say that we both love what we do. I love aquaculture. It is, like, one of my passions. I want to help feed the world. I feel like that's, like, what my skill set is. And we're actually in a long-distance relationship, and we've been living long-distance for going on 3 or 4 years because we both want to pursue our professions, and it's working for us, and we see each other a lot. But I also think it's important – this isn't a woman issue, but it's important for young people to know that science can be tough. You might not get to choose what city you want to live in to do what you want to do. And that's a reality that I think it's important for young people to know and to think about when they're deciding, like, do I want to go into research? Do I want to go into teaching? What kind of science do I like? And it can be really exciting. It can send you all over the world, but it can also be a limitation. Yeah, work-life balance has been better, but has been worse. So, and I also have a partner who's extremely supportive. Over 3 years ago, I was like, I'm moving 2,000 miles away. And he's like, sounds good. Go for it, babe. And so it's just really great to have supportive people in your life, whether it's a partner or family or friends. It's been really great.
So I'll pose the same question to Juliana. We haven't heard from you. How is your life experiences and juggling of life relationships affected your science, or science affected your relationships?
I feel very lucky that I've always made a space for my personal health throughout my science career, in relationship or out. I spent most of my graduate school days ending work at a certain time and making sure I was at the gymnasium, either doing gymnastics or just weight training for my own sanity. So in my personal home life, the things that I need to do on a daily basis, create, play some music, do a push-up, all those things are all there all the time. I was very much luckier to meet a fantastic scientist who is very driven about environmental research, has the same kind of, I guess, almost overwillingness to work super hard for whatever amount of hours as long as he's happy. And our scientific paths can be separate, and then they cross each other in different aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems. So we have found a way to work individually on the things that we love to do for a certain amount of hours, sometimes too many hours. And then we enjoy relaxing moments of crossing paths with our science as well. So my mental capacity to balance a home life of whatever could be going for a walk, could be painting or something that's just not related to building the next experience in my research program. My partner's created a space for that so that our family unit can thrive. Without his support over the last 10 years, it would not have been as easy, but it also was something that I could reciprocate for him. So we both play a very supportive role for each other. And so sometimes I have to play the, you're not doing enough non-science things, you know, take care of yourself. And sometimes I have to do more in that department. And sometimes he has to do more in that department. But from what you've described, Nancy, with your current family situation, it sounds very much similar in terms of we are on the same brainwave of support and science in a way where both of our careers can flourish.
I think I have been sharing incredible moments with upcoming female scientists, LumCon, and they have great potential and great careers ahead of them. So thank you all for allowing me to be the senior member of this group and share my experiences, that yours are going to be so much different. And I hope they're all positive.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nancy. I want to add on to that and say that people like Nancy had it a lot harder because a lot more often they had to walk into a room and be the only one there, the only woman there. And it's a lot easier to walk into a room and see somebody else clearly shares some things with you. And so one thing that Nancy's generation did for us is to be that person in the room that we can walk into and see and feel more comfortable entering that room. And so one thing that I think is important for women in science to remember, especially white women in science like myself, is that we've had those trailblazers and we are in a much better place because of it. And now we have a foothold that some other groups might not, particularly Black, Indigenous, and other women of color. And so we need to use our position to help somehow make it easier for them to enter the room as well.
I agree.
I wanted to add a big thank you also to not only our personal support systems at home when we're balancing work and life, but our very strong, as you can see in the screen, support system at work. That has made all the difference in the easiest times and in the hardest times. And I don't think we would be where we are today without those strong systems, be it any gender, just hanging on to those healthy environments, propelling through hard times with people that will support you and lift you up, and you lift them up at the same time. So big thank you to my colleagues who are also spearheading and supporting me in my career, and hopefully they feel the same way about me in theirs.
Yeah, I echo everyone's sentiment. It's been so fantastic to have Mert and Nancy as female mentors and support people and collaborators at LumCon, and so great to have Juliana and Stephanie join the team. Now we have a lot of females sitting in those faculty meetings. And so it's just been really encouraging on both ends of the spectrum, and I think we're building a really encouraging workplace.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you all for helping us out and being such a good example for people watching and just being willing to be creative and get involved and see now that because of Nancy and people like her, we have that foot in the door. How do we kick it open? So thank you for being a part of that action and that movement.
You're welcome. And as you can see, I'm not the only outspoken person among these four women, and I hope to continue in that.
I'm quiet wallflower. I don't know what you're talking about.
Not a problem, Stacey.